Okay, so welcome. Sorry, we're a bit late. And because we are late, I will waste some more time on some commercial break. So I was asked to show a couple of slides because some of you may be in the final phase or in the last semesters of your bachelor's, and maybe you're not already decided what kind of master program you're going for. And if the Beamer will decide to work at some point. Ah, okay. Somebody used HDMI before me. Okay. I use good old analog technology, but it works. So I was asked to show a couple of slides on the master program in advanced optical technologies. And there is a info event on Monday, 15th at 16:15. It will be here in H15. And yeah, so this room here is Kauerstraße 79, right? So it's exactly here, but it's not right now. And the master program in advanced optical technologies focuses a bit on, of course, optics, and but there's also aspects of physics. And also, you can select topics that will also go into computational optics, and you can also study a bit of computer science. So, in fact, I have nothing to do with the MAOT, but some of you may already be enrolled in MAOT. So there's a couple of MAOT students also taking this class here. And the other thing is, there is also a graduate school, a subsequent PhD program, and that is not directly related to MAOT, but some of the graduates from MAOT also then decide to go for the School of Advanced Optical Technologies, but it's not a requirement to have been in MAOT before you go to SAOT. And SAOT is a PhD graduate school, and it funds PhD programs. Unfortunately, SAOT will only run for another 2 years. So it's part of the Excellence Initiative, and the funding will run out in 2 years. So if you want to acquire SAOT funding, you better be quick. MAOT will continue. So maybe some overview on this program. It's a four-semester program. First semester is fundamentals, optics. Then you can decide for different topics. So in the second, third semester, you can decide for a particular field of study. And the topics that we are kind of related to is computational optics and optics in medicine. So this is image processing is also somehow related to computational optics and optics in medicine. And in the last semester, you write your master thesis. Who is enrolled in MRT here? Is there? Yeah. Is this correct, what I'm telling you? So far, you will stop me if something is wrong, yeah? Okay, so we have three. Why are you in the last row? The overview, yeah. Yeah, and for the next slide, you come to the first row. Yeah, it's international, so it's entirely in English, except for the title slide. And it's interdisciplinary, so all departments of the School of Engineering are part of this, and it's also linked to the Department of Physics and, of course, also with the School of Medicine. And there is, what does integration with graduate school SAOT mean? What does integration with SAOT mean? I thought they are independent. Ah, and you can also, yeah, you can attend the same workshops. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're for free.
Yeah.
So if you're enrolled in MIT, you can go to these summer and winter academies for free.
Yeah, once a year.
Once a year. Ah, okay.
And the other workshops.
Okay, so there's free trips to summer and winter academies associated with the MIT. Why am I presenting this? You could do that much better. You're enrolled in this.
Also, if you want to choose to go to some other summer schools or some conferences, usually MAOT pays for everything. So, for example, there's now this conference in Munich
Yeah.
Which is usually really expensive, but I mean, it pays for the students to go.
Okay. So how difficult is it to get into the study program?
Not too hard for Germans.
Not too hard?
I don't know for international people, but German people it's quite easy.
Okay.
So usually applies about 180 people per year, and about 15 get accepted.
Oh, so that's less than 10%.
And all Germans got accepted.
Yeah.
So there's... so there's... less or equal to 15 German. Okay, be careful. This is an international study program. Okay.
So,
who hasn't decided for a master's program so far? All these efforts, and now everybody is already decided. Okay, so then we will keep this a bit shorter. If you are undecided, yeah. And these are the topics, the fundamentals, and then of course optics and medicine, and optics, computational optics. So these were the two. These are topics. When I work together with SOET, usually one of those two topics are in the programs that we work together. Okay, so I think that's it. End of the commercial break. So there was a lot of support, thank you. But unfortunately, you all are... So who's already enrolled in master's program? Okay, but there's still a few who are not yet enrolled in master's program. Okay, good. Then we can not update, but continue. So we will continue today with our endeavors in segmentation. And what we've seen last time was the random walker. So the random walker was a way of segmenting an image, and it's very low level. So what we essentially use is local neighborhoods, because we, by walking, having the random walker walk, we somehow also encode the distance, and we use edges. So we only used edges and some labels and distance for the segmentation, and this is all very low level. And now we will talk about some very different approach, so such that you can see that there's very different ways into segmentation. So you can work with very close to the image, very data driven, or you can use prior knowledge to drive your segmentation. And this is the contrary approach. This is a statistical shape model, and if you talk about statistics, you already may wonder where these statistics are coming from. So you need some kind of data where you actually learn from. And on these data, you build your statistics, and this will be your statistical shape model. Okay, so there's something wrong with these slides. I have topics, but the topics pop up to be blank all the time. But if I skip this slide over, you will see that the next point is... So essentially, what should appear here is the outline. And what we'll be doing is, there is a paper by Tobias Heimann. So he used to work at Deutsches Krebsforschungszentrum in Heidelberg. And he's now with Siemens. So he's actually only a couple of kilometers far away from here. And he is one of the experts in statistical shape modeling. And Tobias Heimann has written a very nice overview paper, and you can find the reference at the end of this set of slides. But this is more or less a summary of Tobias Heimann's paper. And this would be the outline. So first we go to the introduction, then we will look at a couple of competing approaches. So of course you can also use high-level knowledge other than statistical shape models. We will go through a short motivation. Why do we need statistics at all? Why can't we use other information, or why does it make sense to use those statistics? And then we will go a bit through the method itself, and how the... So we will choose one particular example of statistical shape models, but we will also shortly discuss other options that you could pick for this kind of modeling. And in the end, we will look at a couple of applications, but unfortunately, I didn't bring so many examples. Nonetheless, we will start with our segmentation. And what we want to do now is we want to segment some kind of object. And as you have seen with the random walker, we usually get into trouble if there's quite a bit of noise, or if there's streaks So if you have a strong streak, then your boundaries are either broken or you have artificial boundaries that are detected by a random walker. And then you have to manipulate the labels such that you get a sensible segmentation. Now, active shape, statistical shape models are for fully automatic segmentation. So the idea is that you do not want to spend a lot of time in altering labels, but you want a fully data-driven automatic approach. And the main idea is that you use information about the general shape of the organ. So what you could do is you can segment many organs and then somehow compute something like a mean shape, so the average shape of the organ. And if you have the average shape of the organ, then you can also compute statistics on higher modes of variation, like principal components. And then you allow modification of this mean shape along to the most frequent dimensions of change with respect to this shape. So the idea why we want to use statistics is, of course, in contrast to if you have, for example, a machine or some device that you have designed, you usually have CAD meshes. So you know how this kind of object should look like. And you could use, for example, this this information for segmentation. So if you try to segment some part of a machine, it would be easier to use a computer model to support this. But in human anatomy, it's difficult to describe this kind of organ, because in every human, the organ looks different. So what you do is you need some way to describe those variations. So you expect, well, if you open a book on anatomy, you will find images on specific organs. And this is probably something similar that you could imagine, like the mean shape. So you find some typical sketch of how this organ typically looks like. But an anatomy book does not tell you what is an expected deviation and what is not. And another thing that you can do with these kind of models is you can also describe expected changes, and you could even think about different models for pathologic and not pathologic organs, and then describe expected pathologies or expected normal behavior. So you could even go this far. But typically what you do is you segment healthy organs, because typically pathologic changes in the anatomy can be very, very difficult. So there's a lot of pathologic changes that can happen in anatomy. So typically you include healthy cases for this, but you could also expand it to modeling pathologic variations. Okay, good. So clear. Model-based methods have been used already since the 1990s, successfully in 2D for image segmentation and image processing. And essentially the 2D models can also be extended to 3D. So if you have 2D models, you're typically talking about contours, or mean shape would be a mean contour, which is just a 2D line or the 2D description of a shape. But you can expand it to 3D by using a mesh instead of some kind of line that shows you the contour. So one important thing about what we will do in the following is we will have a model that describes the expected shape, but also the expected appearance. So this is quite interesting that in the modeling, you have two components. You have the component that describes the shape of the heart, and then you have a different component that, which is then called the appearance model, that describes feature spaces or intensities in your data and how you expect them to behave. And the interesting thing is, if you do that, if you split the two, you can train a statistical model on MR and on CT data, which have very different contrasts, but generally the shape of the organ needs to be similar. So what you can do then is you train one shape model and you just replace the appearance model with respect to the contrast mechanism. So if you have CT slices, you take an appearance model for CT intensities, and if you have MR slices, you take an appearance model for MR intensities. So this is also very beautiful about this method, that you can then build multimodal segmentation techniques where you can just replace the appearance model with something that is already adapted to what you expect to see in your slice data. And you typically know that you have a typical MR protocol or what kind of contrast mechanism has been used. And you can also then embed differences in dose. So if you have a higher or lower noise levels, you can also then put that into your appearance model. So the appearance model also describes image properties like noise and things like that implicitly. And in the shape model, you do not have to worry so much about that. So you really separate the two from each other. So this is typically a top-down approach. So you start with the output. So what you want to have is, for example, a segmentation of the heart. And you have the heart description. And this is like the top-level description. And then you go all the way down to the image until you find some shape description that will match your image data. So in the random walker, we had it exactly the other way around. We started with image features, and we actually didn't care too much about the shape because everything was obtained from the image. And you can also see we did that. We did that with the heart, but we had to readjust the segmentation. So very interesting is that it's quite stable. So even if you have very noisy data, the segmentation result will look like a heart. Because the statistical variations will only allow shapes as you expect them. Even if you have a very bad noisy image, you will still segment something which looks like a heart. But now you have to be careful, because it might be the case that your prior knowledge is so dominant that if you show the image of a liver, you will still segment a heart. Yeah? So you have to be careful that you also reuse appropriate data. Otherwise, the failure may still look like a heart segmentation, but in fact, it's just that the prior is so much dominating that you still are segmenting hearts. So you may know the proverb, if you have a hammer, the world looks like a nail. So this is the same thing that might happen here. In industrial applications where you don't expect that large variations, unless you're working on some kind of crash tests, then you can use a single template model. So if you have, if you want to check material properties, and you do industrial CT scans, and then you can use a template model. We just had the case where somebody wanted to analyze crash tests, and this is a much more sophisticated problem, so it will be difficult to work with a single template in such a case. Of course, in medical applications, you need to be able to model the variations. Now, we've been talking about statistical shape models a lot, but of course there's a lot of other competing approaches, and there's also good literature about that. But for the sake of this lecture, we will only select one top-level approach. So this is why we present the statistical shape models. They're pretty popular, and they're also used in practice. But of course, there's other freely deformable models, like snakes or deformable simplex mesh, which is essentially a template shape plus an image fit. So you have an average model, and then you deform the model in such a way that it matches the edge information in your image. So you start deforming such that you get a good fit. And in fact, this is quite simple. But in our approach later, we will only allow deformations in a way as we expect them to happen. So we can only deform our model in a way that it is still an expected variation of what we have seen in our training data. Or if snakes, there you only have the smoothness constraint. There you have, you need to have a smooth shape and you have the image fit. So these are adopted to specific images, but they do not allow the inclusion of prior knowledge of variants of your data. Then something very interesting are level sets. So level sets are also very popular. It's a different segmentation technique. And there you essentially try to describe a shape by the zero crossing of a function. And you have some implicit description. And your shape is actually given as the zero crossing of this level set function. And while this is, so the nice thing is you can have quite versatile functions. So you can use, for example, Gaussian mixtures or other ways of describing the function. And only the zero crossing will be then the expected shape. So you can then alter the position of the Gaussians and move them up and down. And by this, you can create quite versatile shapes. So the big advantage of a level set is, so let's say you want to segment a 1D shape, and you know that you have edges here and here. So let's say it looks like this. So this is your image that you want to segment. And what you see is we essentially have two objects here. And what you could use is something like Gaussian curves, and you can move them in a way that you can split into different areas. So if you have something like a mesh or a contour, if you deform the contour and your contour initially looks like this, you can create something which maybe looks like this. But as if your contour is defined in this way, you cannot deform the contour in a way that it will then turn out to be two separate shapes. And with level sets, you can essentially model this then as means and a threshold value of your Gaussian. And if you do that and define your boundary as this, then you can think about fitting two Gaussian bell curves in here. And of course, you can also do this here. Then they will probably look like this. And you can model something of this, or you can place all two of them into the same location, and it will look like this. Yeah? So if you start using level sets, you can also model stuff like splitting of shapes. Yeah? This is the nice idea with the level sets. And so it's very versatile, but you have to be careful. If you want to integrate prior knowledge, it's more difficult. But in fact, you can do it, and there's references also in Tobias Heimann's paper how to do that. If you want to learn more about level sets, he references a couple of good overview papers, but we won't discuss this here. You can combine it with learning and statistical methods. It's possible. And in fact, this is also a very popular technique of describing shapes. Yeah, one drawback is that your distance maps do not form a linear space, and it can lead to invalid shapes. Yeah, so it may be if you have a hard model, you can also end up with segmentations that do no longer look like a hard. Yeah, if you use such a kind of modeling scheme, just because you can end up in tearing the hard or stuff like that. So there's a nice paper by Kremers et al., which you can also find in the reference paper. Good. Generally, if you this has the wrong heading. So generally, if you talk about statistical shape models, excuse me.
I have a question.
Yes. Yes.
But there's no zero crossings in Gaussian.
Yeah. Well, yes. You have to define a threshold here. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. That's the level that you need to set. Yeah. Okay. But you can also take a polynomial, and then you can take zero crossings. So it depends on the kind of model. Yeah. True. Back. But let's forget about level sets. back to our statistical shape models. What you need to do generally, statistical shape model is a general concept. And the first thing that you need to do is you have to pick a shape presentation. So you can pick any kind of shape representation that you know, and then build a statistical shape model from that. But first thing when you're building a statistical shape model is you have to define or select a shape representation. So what we will do is we will use landmarks. You will see that in the following. When you have selected the shape representation, you have to extract the principal modes. So you have to compute your mean shape and the expected variation. In fact, this is quite simple because it essentially is just a computation of a principal component analysis. But you have to prepare your data, and the data preparation is the kind of tricky thing. So if you do not prepare the data right, you will end up with very strange statistical variations. Once you have extracted the principal modes, or in order to be able to extract the principal modes, you have to somehow find correspondences between shapes. So we are building statistics on shapes. And in order to build statistics on shapes, we need to be able to align them to each other. So they must be corresponding to each other. And this is also quite tricky. Once you have selected a way of figuring out correspondences, then you still need to think about the appearance modeling. And we will discuss only something very simple. So we will just use intensity similarity for the appearance modeling. But you can also use machine learning approaches. You can use feature spaces. So there's plenty of things that you could explore for the appearance modeling. And then in the end, we will look into the application. And before we do that, we will actually look into the so-called active shape model algorithm. So the active shape model algorithm then brings together the statistical shape model and the appearance model, and then it's essentially the alignment problem. How to, if you have the statistical shape model, how can you align it to a current image? That will be the active shape model algorithm. So there's the statistical shape model, there's the appearance model, and the actual segmentation is then performed with the so-called active shape model, and it's called active because it's the search algorithm. Then we look in some applications and some outlook. Good. The topics are still not working, but this would be the overview again. But now we jump into shape representation. Okay. So, So there's already examples. So for example, you can use segmented volumetric images. If you have a segmentation of an image of an organ, you already have some kind of shape representation. You could use, for example, meshes. So meshes are pretty popular, but you can also use any other shape representation that can be converted into one of the above. So you can also use B-splines, NURBS, and so on. Yeah, there's many different ways. So you may know many other methods of describing shapes, right? And you have to select one. Be aware that once you select the shape, you have to live with that, and you have to live with the advantages and disadvantages of this shape. So, in our case, we will actually go for landmarks. So, which we'll explain in the next few slides. Do you know more things how to describe shapes? Other ways of describing shapes? Yes?
Meshes.
Surface meshes. Meshes are actually super popular. And there's a lot of... So meshes are popular because there's different processing algorithms for meshes from computer graphics. So you may know how to remove points from a mesh and by preserving the global shape. And meshes are very useful. And this is one of the most popular methods. And B-splines have the advantage that they are guaranteed to be smooth. But with B-splines, you have you can very easily sample points on a B-spline surface, but it's very difficult to compute intersections with the B-spline surface because you essentially have to create a triangle, a mesh representation from the B-spline that will be quick, but it's only as accurate as your mesh is. And what you could do else is you could really use an intersection algorithm, but that typically ends up in an iterative solution scheme. So you have to run, let's say, 4 or 5 iterations, or depending on how many iterations you run, the more accurate your intersection will be. So this is a disadvantage of the B-spline. So meshes are very popular. Segmented volumetric images are not that popular. And what you typically do is you convert a volumetric image into a surface mesh. Do you know how to generate a mesh from a segmented volumetric image? So what's a segmented volumetric image at all? Yes?
Just all the boxes marked which
are the border. So it's essentially a 0-1 representation. Yes, exactly. So you can do marching cubes in order to solve it. And if you do marching cubes, you typically want to do some mesh smoothing afterwards. And marching cubes will generate a lot of mesh points. So because you get 2 triangles per voxel or something, and you end up with a lot of triangles in your mesh. And you can also then start reducing the mesh points. We will see later why we typically want to reduce the number of mesh points. First of all, the correspondence problem is difficult because for every vertex in your mesh, you need a corresponding vertex in all the other meshes. And then we do statistical analysis. And of course, this is also something which will increase the dimensionality of your problem if you have a lot of cubes or if you have a lot of mesh points. Okay, we will use landmarks and meshes. And in fact, we will only use landmarks. It's very simple, but it turns out to be quite good. And it's very generic. So what you do is you write your entire mesh, your entire shape description into a long vector. So you take this vector, you call it X, and you put in the first vertex of your mesh, you put in as X, Y, Z, so it's a 3D point, and then you add all the other mesh points. And you call all the mesh points landmarks. And the nice thing is, you can store this in a vector. It's just a single vector to describe your entire mesh. And all of the edge information you can just keep as known, as constant. So you enforce you just keep the topology of your mesh to be constant over all your different shapes. So, and in this way, you only have to describe the actual vertex positions, and you call every vertex in your mesh you call landmark. And you could do it just using real landmarks. So landmark would be an anatomic structure that you can really identify. So if you have some particular tip of a bone or some point of high curvature on an organ, this is something that you could identify as a landmark. And this is also what you would find in the anatomy books. So the anatomy books, they also describe specific positions on organs, and this would be something which you could use as a landmark. But you may think of that there's actually quite few of those points. So in a typical organ, maybe you have 10, 15, even if you have 30 of these landmarks and you want to describe a rather complex shape, the number of points may be not enough. So if you think of a mesh that consists only of 10 points, it will be a very coarse mesh. So what you do instead is you add some more points, and in fact you select as many points such that you have a quite good description of this mesh. And if you do that, not all of the points that you actually selected are actually landmarks. So not all of them have a very good anatomic interpretation as you would find it in an anatomy book. So And for this reason, those landmarks are often called semi-landmarks. So because there is not, it's not really a landmark in a traditional sense, but it is just a landmark because we need it for our mesh and it describes our topology. So you could just use points, but this would probably not be sufficient to deliver a segmentation afterwards. So imagine if we only use points, what we will get later in the segmentation, once the segmentation is done, we will find an adopted set of points that match the current volumetric image. And if you only have points, you still have to think about the connectivity. So what you typically do is you fix the connectivity in the training phase. All of the landmarks are connected in the same way. Then you only work on positions of landmarks, and then you use the connectivity from the original mesh in order to produce the final segmentation mesh. And if you only use landmarks as a basis for statistical shape models, this yields a so-called point distribution model. So this is because we are only working on landmark positions, so it's actually a point distribution model. But it's sufficient and it will work, and we will stay with this example. Of course, you can also use other ways of building statistical shape models. And one very popular choice are so-called medial models. And they use center lines and radii. So they use the radius for a specific center line point. And you would choose such a model if you want to segment a vessel. So if you want to build a model of the aorta, it's much easier to actually find the center line of the aorta than to describe good landmarks and good meshes of the entire aorta. And you can also use the center line and the different radiuses, so the radii. So if you have a different radius at every point, then you can also use that. If you really have that in 3D, you call it MRAP. And from this MRAP, you can then construct a mesh description again. So if you have, you can imagine that this probably then looks like this. So, and then you have different distances to your contour edge. And you could also imagine doing this in 3D, right? And this would be perpendicular to your center line. You measure the distance to the expected, so where your vessel is, like this. So this is your vessel. But your model actually looks like this. And of course, you know the orientations of these points, so you can get those points. And then you can connect all the points that lie on the boundary to form a mesh again. So you can also convert this back. But this is an MRAP representation. You can also use Fourier surfaces. You can use spherical harmonics and also NURBS, non-uniform rational B-splines, where you not just have B-splines, but you can also assign a weight for every control point and then deform that. Yeah, and wavelets and so on. So there's many different other ways of modeling, but we'll look into point distribution models now. Okay, so what do we need to do next? We have to somehow extract a mean shape. And typically, depending on your training data, you select the number of modes of variation that you want to describe. So in the following, we will look at point distribution models with known correspondence. So in the next couple of slides, we will neglect the correspondence problem. So imagine if you do 10 manual segmentations, for example, using the random walker of the liver, and then you end up with a volumetric image, then you run marching cubes, and then you have 10 different meshes, and you still have to solve the correspondence problem because the vertices of one mesh will not necessarily match the vertices of a different mesh. So this we will talk about in the next few slides, but for the time being, we assume that every vertex has a correspondence in all of the other meshes. So there's different methods to guarantee that you can actually do that. So if we have 10 different segmentations of this organ, we know that point number one and mesh number one will be corresponding to point number one in mesh number 10 and in mesh number 7 and so on. So this is what we assume in the following. And if we have such correspondence, then we can, what we first should do is we should align those shapes. And in order to do that, we will compute, we will get rid of translation, rotation, and scaling. So because shape, let's say you have the liver of a patient that is heavier or bigger than another patient, then generally the expected shape may be similar, but the organ size and of course the rotation and translation, so the patient might be lying in a different way in the scanner, so the translation and rotation is of course different. So first we need to get rid of these effects, and we do that by aligning all those shapes with each other. And this alignment or normalization is traditionally done by generalized Procrustes alignment. Have you heard the term Procrustes before? Yes? What's Procrustes?
It's a mathematical approach.
It's a mathematical approach.
For Yip's problem, and ICP uses it sometimes.
Yes, yes, it's related to ICP.
Yes, you try to break on a problem into another one.
Yeah, it's a kind of brute force approach. Who knows Greek mythology? This is a Greek term. Procrustes is a titan. Who knows what a titan is? Yes?
The old gods.
Yeah.
But he killed them.
Yeah, he got rid of them. So Zeus got rid of the titans, and the titans are essentially the old gods. And one of these titans was called Procrustes. And in Greek mythology, so Procrustes is essentially the inventor of one size fits all, because he was running an inn, and in his inn he had a bed, and whenever a traveler would come to his inn, he would ask him to stay overnight, and he would stay there. But if the bed wouldn't fit, he would just make it fit, and he did not change the bed, but instead he changed the traveler. And if the traveler was not small, was too small, he would just stretch the traveler. And if the traveler was too tall, he would just start chopping off parts of the body until he fits the bed. So this is Procrustes. It's it's in, from Greek mythology. And because what we essentially will be doing here is we will do something very similar. We will just force those shapes to match each other. So we are not doing something very intelligent. We are just forcing the shapes to match each other. And we do a kind of brute force approach. And this is why they chose the elegant name of Procrustes. But what they actually want to say is we just do a brute force alignment of all the shapes. And what you do then is you just try to minimize the mean square distance between two shapes. So what you have, so if you just do Procrustes alignment, you have a reference shape and a base shape, and you take the two shapes, move them to each other, so you're more or less doing something. It's not iterative closest point, because iterative closest point also takes care of the different correspondences. But you just move the corresponding points to each other, and then you compute a rotation and translation such that they are oriented towards each other, and of course scale. So you get one transformation. Now in our shape modeling approach, we have the general problem that we don't know what the correct base shape is. So what we can do is, we can just compute a mean shape, where you just take the average of all our landmarks, and then we align to our mean shape. So we align all our 10 shapes to the mean shape, compute rotation and translation, and once we have that, we can update the mean shape and iterate. So this is generalized Procrustes alignment. So it's a brute force method of matching those shapes into the same coordinate frame. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't get it now. So we're aligning the shapes so we can build up the mean shape. And now we say we're using the mean, so we just
yes.
have
yeah.
them unaligned.
Yeah.
So you calculate the mean shape from
yes.
unaligned.
Yes.
And then this is guaranteed to converge to the mean shape. Why? I don't get it. Because if they are totally out of scaling, for example, then this mean shape will be horrible.
Yes. So you can just start with initial estimate of mean shape is shape one. Then you align everything to shape one. Then you compute the mean shape and then you iterate. Of course, if you have a mean shape that is just all the points at zero, then you will also find a very good alignment of all the points, but then they all will fall into zero. So you, yes, it's a heuristic method. Yeah. Yeah. So you end up, but the reason why it's been used, it's quite good. If you use it in a sensible way, you end up with quite good alignments. You can use other norms than L2, and you can also go into tangent space. And yeah, one thing is, this alignment needs to be pretty good. If you mess up this alignment, the misalignment will propagate into your expected shapes. So you have to check whether the initial alignment that you produce with your generalized Procrustes alignment has to be quite good. If it's not good, what you will get is, because later we do statistical analysis and if we have a kind of bias in the alignment, this bias of the alignment will propagate into the statistics, which will cause the expected variations to look very strange, because what you're expecting is a variation in alignment, actually, rather than in variation in shape. So you really have to check if your alignment makes sense, and then you can go the next step. So you really have to check that. And if you don't get a good alignment, there's a couple of references what you can try in order to improve the alignment. Okay, so now we have aligned all the shapes, and they're in a kind of standard shape coordinate system now. So they all are more or less in the same alignment, and the only, because we only had rotation, translation, and scale varying, the only remaining factor that is different between the aligned shapes is truly shape. And what we do now is we compute a mean shape. So again, we compute this mean shape. And we can compute a covariance matrix. And you can just use a traditional way of computing a covariance matrix. So you take each of your shapes, subtract the mean shape, and multiply it with the same vector transpose. And this is just a multi-dimensional covariance matrix. At this point, it's quite interesting to think about the number of landmarks. So if you have a lot of landmarks, you will end up with very long vectors here, because you have many landmarks. And if you have very long vectors here, you also will start building quite big covariance matrices here. So if you are able to cut down the number of landmark points at an earlier point in the processing, it makes sense to do that. And it makes sense to reduce the landmark points, of course, if you still can get good correspondences. So once you have done that, you build the covariance matrix, and then you can do an eigenanalysis of the covariance matrix, and then you get eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And with those, you can describe the modes of variation. And what you typically do is you fix a number of eigenvectors that we'll use in the statistical shape analysis. And for example, you can do that by looking at the eigenvalues and how they perform. So one way of doing this is the so-called scree test. So this is a heuristic to select the number of eigenvectors. So you can order the eigenvalues by size, and then you will probably find some structure like this. And then you typically have a quite steep drop, and you get something like this, or you can you get some kind of function that will be monotonously decreasing. And in order to figure out how many modes of variation you should preserve, you can think of explained variance. So this is one way. So you can account up to the eigenvalues until you are able to describe this. Is, so let's say 90% of the variation that you expect in the data. Or you can just pick something very simple like the Scree test, which says you connect. So this is a heuristic again. So but it typically works quite well. You take the first point and the second point, and then you linear extrapolate, and you pick all of the points left of the intersection with zero. So this is a Scree test, and typically it works quite well. Or you can consider how much variance you can explain in the data or so on. When you did that, you end up with a number of modes of variation. And with that, you can then build a statistical shape model, and you can also visualize it. And what you see down here is a visualization of the statistical shape model. So here you find the mean shape. And then, so this is three modes of variation. So let me no, this is only two different. So this is a liver shape. So first of all, it's a liver shape. And what you can see here is the first three modes of variation. And here we then took, actually the authors of the paper took the mean shape and added three times the eigenvalue to the one direction and to the other direction of the eigenvector. Yeah? What you get now is you get a set of eigenvectors, and now you can compose, you can describe a shape. So this is actually on the next slide. Let's look at this one first. So what you can do now is you can construct shapes with this kind of description. And you do that by taking the mean shape, and then you have selected, let's say, three components. So this is C, this is the number that you get, or our example here is four components. So you have selected four components. And now you can construct a shape by taking the mean shape plus some value times the eigenvector, and then you sum up over all of the eigenvectors. This is one way of constructing a shape. And you typically choose your BM in a way that is, it is in the interval from minus three times the eigenvalue to plus three times the eigenvalue. So you do not over-exaggerate this particular eigenvector that goes into this direction of the shape. So in this way, we are able to describe shapes, and all those shapes match, or these shapes follow, the expected variations, and the direction of expected variation is described by the eigenvector. And if we do that now, we can generate different shapes from our mean shape. And for example, we can vary the eigenvector number one, number two, and number three. And what you actually find on this page here is this is a variation along the first. Along the first eigenvector, this is a variation along the second eigenvector, and this is a variation along the third eigenvector. So these are typical deformations of the liver. And you can see this, that there is a lot of deformation happening in the liver. It's nicer if you put that in a video, and then you can see how it deforms. Okay, good. Some remarks. Of course, you can also use SVD for this. So you can use SVD on the aligned landmark matrix, which will also give you a kind of shape model. And another thing is you can also use ICA. So you can also use other methods of decomposing. And this will, so for ICA, you are looking for independent components. You're trying to match an independent basis in terms of your modes of variation. But remember, if you use ICA, you don't have this nice property as in PCA, where you really have an ordering of the components corresponding to the eigenvalues. Okay. Any questions so far? So far we have chosen one way of representing the shape. We chose landmarks. Then we have aligned them all, computed a mean shape, and extracted the modes of variation. So this is essentially our shape statistics. What we now have to talk about is how we can actually build meshes with correspondences. And there's three popular choices. So one thing that you can do is you can use manual landmarks. But as soon as you're talking about 3D shapes, this has such a high effort that it's typically infeasible. So what you typically like to do is you like automatic methods to finding these correspondences. And one way of doing this is, for example, with a mesh-to-mesh registration. So you do volumes, you segment them, like with a random walker, and then you have several segmentations, and then you can use something like ICP. So ICP we heard in diagnostic medical image processing. And in this way, we align all those meshes, and then we are able to generate a single aligned mesh. And we will keep the correspondences from our iterative closest point procedure. Then there is be aware there's a couple of mistakes on these slides. So what we do here is we segment the volume and get a mesh. So this is the random walker, this is okay. And then we can generate something like a mean shape, and we can do an ICP registration here. You could refer to this shape. You can just select shape number one, and you could refer to this as an atlas shape. And this is the way how you then propagate the landmarks. But be careful, don't mix up those different approaches. So this is a mesh-to-mesh kind of landmark propagation. So this is, let's say the slide is suboptimal. Then what you can also do is you can do a mesh to volume registration. So let's say you already have an active shape model, then you can use, for example, the active shape model to segment new volumes. And if you do that, you can then propagate those landmarks. So you can, or you use, instead of an active shape model, you use a freely deformable mesh or something like that. So this way you have a mesh-based segmentation, and you map the mesh into the volume. And the nice thing is, if you do that, your landmarks will all stay the same because your mesh is deformed in the same way. So you're deforming a prototype mesh, and you match it to the volume. And this way you automatically propagate all the landmarks. So you don't have to think about correspondence about this, but it may introduce a bias. And another very popular approach is that you do volume to volume. So in fact, you are no longer solving a segmentation problem, but you convert it to a registration problem. So what you do is you take one volume and do a segmentation. You put a lot of effort in the segmentation, but then you only have a single volume that is segmented. And with the single volume, you do a non-rigid registration to all the other volumes. And because you have a non-rigid volumetric registration, which means that every point of the volume you have computed a vector that will point to a corresponding point in the other volume. And if you have that, then you have your segmentation, and you can just use the deformation field from the volume 1 to volume 2, or from this reference volume to the other volumes, and you just take your mesh that was generated for this volume, and you just deform the mesh in the same way as you would deform the volume from the non-rigid registration. And this way, you can propagate your original mesh to different volumes. And this is often also called atlas segmentation. So you have one segmented volume where you have spent a lot of time with, and it's a very accurate segmentation. And then you use a deformation so a non-rigid registration in order to propagate this into a new volume. Yes? Well, this is one instance. So this is one segmented volume. But you don't have any statistics at this point. So you can't compute statistics from a single volume. And what you do is you register, you compute the deformation between patient 1 and patient 2. And then because you know the deformation, you can take the segmentation from patient 1 and deform it in the same way such that it matches patient 2. And of course, this is kind of imperfect. So what you probably want to do is, if you spend a lot of time with it and if you have the manpower to do it, you can start with something like this atlas-based registration. So this is some kind of also bootstrapping approach. So you take one well-segmented volume, then you do a non-rigid registration to a couple of other volumes that are hopefully not that different. So you select patients that look quite similar, then you can do the non-rigid registration because then the non-rigid registration problem is not that hard. And in this way, you can then propagate one shape into another volume, and hopefully it doesn't make too many errors during this transfer. Then you can load that new registration, correct it, and once you have the corrected registration, corrected segmentation, then you can start building, for example, an active shape model. Or you could use atlas segmentation again, because then you suddenly have 10 different atlases. Yeah? But they're very similar. And then you choose the next similar volumes that are similar to those 10. And this way you can, let's say your image space looks something like this. So this is a dimensionality reduction of our volumetric data. So I can compute something like this with Semon transform or PCA or whatever kind of dimensionality reduction method you do. So I can project this into a lower dimensional space, or actually I don't need the dimensionality reduction, I just could use Euclidean distances. And what I do is, let's say I picked, so first of all, if I have a lot of data, and if I want to generate a new mesh segmentation, then I probably pick this point. I take this point and I do my manual segmentation. And then I pick this, and maybe this one, and I try to propagate my segmentation onto those 4 points, and then I check the segmentation, and then I can propagate this one to here, probably this one to here, this one to here, and this one to here, and in this way I can bootstrap my entire data. Probably you don't have this problem with 15 points, but you want to have maybe 100 different volumes where you try to propagate your segmentation through. So this is one way of constructing this. Just a remark, the beauty of the random walker is we don't need any training data. Yeah? So we can just go right away. If we start building statistics and prior knowledge, we have a lot of effort that we have to spend in building up those training data. And these training data are very expensive. And you have groups that have already segmented hundreds of organs for a specific organ. And typically, or at least a couple of years ago, they did not want to share any of these data. So they would publish on their data and show that they can get better if they use more data and they can get very beautiful results. But they would not like to share these data because there's hundreds of hours of manpower that went into the segmentation. And only recently, because, I mean, then you have these groups and they have this data, and one group is working on statistical shape models, others are using level sets, but they're using entirely different data they don't want to share. Of course, this is all medical data, so also sharing this data is a problem. And then you really have trouble comparing level sets with active shape models. So this is really difficult because everybody is using different data, and you compute very different accuracy methods, accuracy measures on different data. And at some point in the last few years, they came up that they are organizing something that they call a challenge, and their groups of researchers have formed teams where they throw together data and also annotate data together and share it with the entire community. And they say, okay, so in the beginning, those challenges were pretty small. So they would only publish, let's say, 3 data sets or 5 data sets. And then they say, okay, but I published this data set, and now everybody else in the world can evaluate his algorithm on this data. And it started with rather small challenges, and by now there's also big European projects that are working on this, and you can get 80 volumes with, let's say, 10 different organs segmented as a basis for a challenge. And now people are sharing this, and this helps also if you want to contribute or if you have your own ideas of refining the registration, you can then probably not just download the data, but you still have to send them an email and get to know them. But they will share the data, and then you don't have the problem as much that this lack of training data is really a big problem. But still, as you may know, if you do learning-based methods, there's nothing better than more data. So, of course, if you had more data, then you would probably build much bigger and much better segmentation. Concerning data, if you think about speech recognition hasn't been working very well in, let's say, 5 or 7 years ago. It was a really, really a pain, and you couldn't work with it. And at that time, people were using they were using humongous amounts of data. So they had 600 hours or 1,000 hours of annotated speech data. So every single vowel, every single phoneme in the data was annotated by hand and corrected. You can imagine, in order to annotate 1 hour of speech, you typically use 10 hours of work labor. So for 600 hours, you need 6,000 hours of work to actually annotate that. And it's a very tedious work, so you can't do that all day because you need a lot of concentration. And today we have speech recognition systems on your mobile, and it works very well. It's transmitted to a server. And if you think about Google, Google is using 1 million hours of speech to train their speech recognizer. And this is how you get from 95% accuracy. So the speech recognizers 5 or 7 years ago were about 95% accuracy. And it was crap. So every 20th word is not recognized correctly. And now they are beyond 99%, and the main difference is the amount of data that they're using. So now, and imagine doing this with medical data, volumes. So you are now happy if you have 80 volumes with 5 or 10 organs segmented. And imagine you want to do that one day with millions of volumes to build these statistics. So probably you also have to do a slightly more sophisticated modeling, yeah?
I have one technical question. So there's for sharing medical volumes, there's this standard, what was it named? So
DICOM.
Yeah, DICOM.
Yes.
And but for annotating, so for doing this gold standard segmentation, for annotating this stuff, is there also a similar standard?
There is DICOM RT, and this is radiation therapy, and it also includes meshes and volumetric segmentations, because you use that for radiation therapy planning. So if you want to compute organ doses and stuff like that, there is a part in the DICOM standard that is being used really by radiation therapy systems in order to avoid irradiating structures of high radiosensitivity. Okay. Yeah. So there's a lot of work that goes into this training data, and imagine how much work you really have to spend to segment 80 data sets with 10 organs each. So it's many hours. And There is commercial systems that have been trained with hundreds of training data sets. So, and of course, you don't want to share this. If you imagine the work hours that you have paid for this segmentation, you don't want to give this away because this was really costly. And this is, but with these challenges, it started to change, and now we are starting to build better systems. Okay, so far we only talked about the shape, but now we also need to talk about the appearance. And the appearance is actually how the model looks in the image. So what you can do is now you can go through all our feature descriptors and feature transforms that you know and use them. But what we will do is just look at boundary-based features. So we may use intensity only or intensity plus derivatives. But you can use texture, like Gabor wavelets. You can use distances. You can use the good old SIFT. You can use classifiers. So you can train a classifier for every vertex in your mesh and use the classifier output as a kind of appearance model. So what the appearance model will do is it will measure how well the vertex matches the current position in the image. That's all it does. And what you can do then is, let's say you have your image. This will actually follow. So this now goes already into the direction of the active shape model. So let's say this is the structure in your image that you want to segment. And then you need some rough initialization. And this is the current estimate of the position. And what you do now is you can take the shape and walk along the normals and search for spots where you have a better match with the shape. So you already see in this figure why also a huge number of landmarks is a problem. So if you have a lot of landmarks, you will have to go through many points here for the searching. If you have fewer landmarks, then you also have less normals that you have to go through to search. And what you do now is you walk along this range here, and then you pick the point that you find the best match with the actual image. So this is probably, let's say we're looking for edges, then the best matches would be probably here. Then you, and this is done by the appearance model. So the appearance model tells you how does this vertex look like in the image. And of course, you also need to train that. So you need some kind of training algorithm, or you could just, in intensity-based, you could just extract a profile along the normal of your vertex from the image, and then just use this profile and do a template match to get some kind of distance measure. And at the point where the template matches best, you can find the match of the appearance model. So what the appearance model does, it delivers a good fit for a specific landmark. And every landmark has a different appearance model. And what you do now is you need to search. So you need some kind of initialization, because you need to know where you're looking at. So you initialize, you can either do this by a user interaction, so you have to click at some point, or you can do histograms, you can do particle filters. So there's many ways of initializing this. But a popular one is user interaction, or also marginal space learning and bounding box detectors are also very popular. So you build a detector for the center of the liver that gives you a bounding box, and then you use the bounding box to fit your mean shape, and from that you already get a very quite good initial estimate, hopefully something like this, and then you start your active shape model algorithm. And how do we do that? Well, first, let's say this is our initial situation, this is our initialization, and now we do exactly apply our appearance model. So we take these normals and find the best match of the appearance model. And what we will do now is we will move our vertices to these positions. So then we get a deformation of our shape. And this deformation may not be explained by our statistical shape model. So what we do is we move them to these positions, and then we look for a statistical shape model, so it's the mean shape plus the modes of variation that actually match this new point configuration. And then we can update the rotate. Oh, sorry. So first we find the matching points. Then we update rotation and translation. And once we have updated rotation and translation, we already get a better match of the two. And now we update our parameter vector b. So b was the modes of variation. You remember that? So these were the values that were assigned to the eigenvectors. So this is our parameter vector b. So first, we have the initialization. Then we detect the matching points. Then we try to rotate and translate it to the matching points. And then we try to update the shape according to the variations that are allowed. And once we did that, we iterate. So then we again evaluate the appearance model, and we try to find the best fit of our shape model onto our image data. Okay. Yeah, so this is, and this is then why it's called an active shape model, because the active part is the search algorithm. So this is how you decode your expected shape into the image. Yeah, so the active appearance model then combines, that's active shape model. Why does it say active appearance model? So there you combine shape and appearance into a single model. And the nice thing is you can compute all these updates as a linear system of equations and then do the updates. Good. Do you have any questions so far about this appearance modeling and how this active shape modeling works? Okay. Yes?
I have one. You said before you go along the normals of the visualization.
Yes.
Outside,
yes.
Inside or not.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And when I have the ideal case, so I have found a corresponding point, why can't I just compute the ideal rotation and translation and update the finally? So why I have to iterate?
Well, you first. Move your vertices with procrustes, and this doesn't change the shape. So this just changes rotation and translation.
And the
update B is that you adjust the shape to match the current detected shape. And you do, of course, the rotation and translation first, because otherwise you try to explain a movement by a shape modification, and that doesn't make sense. So first you have to try to move it to the right position, and then you update the shape, because we just said shape is invariant of rotation, translation, and scale. Okay? Good. So this is the active shape model as a whole, as a search algorithm. And now we can have a look at a couple of applications. And of course, you can find, yes?
Sorry, one question. If you go 2 slides back.
Yes.
So I update orientation first. Mm-hmm. And then I update the shape.
Yes.
So doesn't this imply that my variation in shape has to be a lot smaller than the variation which can occur in space? So if, for example, the shape can vary a lot and some points can be totally outside,
mm-hmm.
so I could
wrongly flip, for example, my whole shape. So.
Yeah. So, I think a quite crucial point is that you need a quite good rough initialization. So there's if you want this to work quite stable, you need to have the orientation and the scale approximately correctly. So if you're off entirely with your initialization, you may end up in flipping the shape or not finding a very good fit. Yeah. That's true.
It was more along the lines of if my organ will rise over time a lot. So for example, the heart.
Yeah.
And I get the heart phase which looks very different and, for example, a lot, pressed. So I could imagine that I can't...
So with the heart, you typically also include the motion into the shape model. So you would have landmarks over time in your vector. So what you can do is you can build an entire 4D model in this context. And then you take the matching, because you typically have ECG triggering, and then you know the corresponding heart state. And of course, you pick that model that is the closest to the corresponding heart state. But heart segmentation is tough. Yeah, it's true. And then, yeah. There's also ways of trying to first register closed time points and then using the redundancies that you have there also to build more stable models. Yes?
So if I have many features and I already have a model, why don't I initialize with a model using the lowest variance of all?
So if you already have... Yeah.
There's a feature that has very low variance, so I can generate a model only using this type of feature with the low variance as an initialization.
So you're talking about the appearance model, or?
Yes.
Yes?
Or a shape model.
Yeah. Yeah, which one? The appearance model is only used here for searching along the normals.
And you don't find good solutions. So you said it's crucial to the initialization.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And now when I use, when I have some experience with this, I use the smallest eigenvalue or the smallest variant feature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can initialize with the smallest.
You would initialize with the mean shape. You would initialize with the mean shape, yeah, because it's also the most likely to appear.
Okay.
Yeah. It should be, on average, the closest to what you expect. So this is the expected shape, the mean shape. Okay, we can also discuss this later. Okay. Good. Then we can go to a couple of applications, and you find active shape models virtually in all body regions. You can do organs, heart, liver, but you can also find that for bones. So it turns out that that your vertebrae, they are quite so they have quite some variation. You can find it for the knee, for the femur bone. There's many applications where active shape models have been used successfully, just for segmentation. And the next step is once you have the segmentation, you can then also build on further interpretation. So for example, you can if you have the hippocampus segmented, then there is also people who build further on this and they start extracting features, and one of the features could be the B vector that you get from your shape representation. So if you have an active shape model segmentation, you automatically also have a vector of these B values, and those B values can be used as a feature interpretation for further processing. So if you want to detect schizophrenia or Alzheimer's disease, then you can use this in a classification task as a feature or for the analysis of aging. And you can also do a shape extrapolation. So this is also something quite interesting. So you can build, for example, a 3D plus T hard model. So you have an entire 3D shape. And then you acquire, for example, 2D plus T MR data. So you pick two slices in a perpendicular way, or three slices through the heart. And you can image three slices very quickly in MR. So you don't acquire the entire volume, but you just image three slices through the heart. And then you use your 3D plus time model and do a 2D plus time segmentation in all of these three slices at the same time. And then you can extrapolate the entire heart motion only from the three slices that you have been acquiring. So this is also a very interesting application of shape models. So you can extrapolate, and because you have an expected heartbeat and you only observe the heartbeat in specific slices, you can still do an estimate of how the entire heart is actually moving. And there's many more applications. So this is a quite interesting technology. So you can also embed it. You can even go that far and regularize a registration problem with a kind of shape model. Or there's also things like known component reconstruction, where you know that, so known component reconstruction is mostly if you have an implant and you have a CAD sketch of the implant, then you can do a joint segmentation of this implant and combine it with a reconstruction approach in order to improve image quality. And of course, you can also take other models and embed it here. But there we are already in the future. So this is active shape model segmentation. So you can do it quite quickly, but if you iterate over it, it will still take some time. So you can find active shape models already used in medical applications, and there's very successful overlays that have been generated with this. So if you have a 3D scan of a volume, then you segment out a certain structure, and then you can use it for interventional overlay, for example. This is also what is done with active shape models. Okay, good. And here is finally the paper that I'm referencing to all the time. So this is by Tobias Heimann and Hans-Peter Mainzer. And this is a very nice review. And the paper is also a very good read. So you can go onto the web. So if you're in the university network, you should also be able to download the paper from Medical Image Analysis from 2009. Very nice overview paper. Okay. Do you have any questions so far? Well, you ask your questions on the way. Then see you on Thursday.